McClanahan is there. The puck is still loose. 11 seconds. You've got 10 seconds. The countdown going on right now. Morrow up to Schultz. 5 seconds left in the game.
It's over.
You believe in miracles? Yes!
You know, I'm sitting here and I've got chills running up and down my spine as I listen to that. Sometimes miracles happen, and sometimes they happen on ice. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. February 22nd will be the 40th anniversary of the U.S. men's Olympic hockey team's iconic win against the Soviet Union. I'm going to talk about that win, the team, and why it meant so much with our guest, Wayne Coffey. He's a great sports journalist, former writer for the New York Daily News. He's an author of 7 books, one of them the New York Times bestseller, The Boys of Winter, the untold story of a coach, a dream, and the 1980 U.S. Olympic hockey team. It's just been, that book has just been re-released in time for the 40th anniversary of that event. Do you remember that game? Excuse me. I hope you'll join the conversation today with your questions or comments. Give us a call. The number's 1-800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Wayne Coffey with us by phone. Wayne, thank you for taking time to be with us.
Thanks for having me on, Larry. It's good to be with you. I think we did this when the miracle was only 25 years old. So we shouldn't be talking so often, you know.
Every five years.
Before we get into miracle stuff, Larry, I just want to let you know that for the record, if I were a female college hockey player, I could not imagine wanting to play for anyone else other than Mark Johnson.
Oh, man. Magic, as he was called.
That's it. Magic. He was the hockey Magic Johnson, and for good reason. He was the best player on that team, and he delivered the goods not only in the epic Soviet game, but for those that...
Oh, we lose you there, Wayne? Oh, we lost Wayne. Well, I'll tell you what, we'll get him back in just a second here. Wayne Coffey, our guest, as I said, he has written this wonderful, wonderful book. It's called The Boys of Winter, The Untold Story of a Coach, a Dream, and the 1980 U.S. Olympic Hockey Team. And we lost him for a second. I don't know if we got him back yet. Nigel, we got him back yet? No, Nigel's working on getting him back.
I'm here, Larry.
Oh, you're there. Okay, we lost you for a second.
Yeah, somebody found me, and it's good to be found.
It is good to be found. Oh, man, it's good to find you, that's for sure. Well, you know, you wrote that book 25 years after the fact. I love that book. I love your book, and it was so much fun to take a look at it again, the way you put it together and everything. But somebody asked me, why do you wait 25 years?
Well, you know, I've always been a little slow on the uptake. you know, the truth is, Larry, this is my bad all the way, and I'm embarrassed to even admit this, but when my editor and I were talking about possible projects around 2002, 2003, he said, what about a 25th anniversary book of the Miracle on Ice? And I thought, you know, I mean, it was an incredible moment, and I had goosebumps just as you did when you replayed the final seconds. And I just thought, you know, we sort of know everything we need to know about this, don't we? And boy, was I wrong. And really, it was as enjoyable and gratifying a project as I've ever worked on, because they're what I really try to do in the book, Larry, is we know the outcome, but I tell the journeys of the players and, you know, how they got there and the struggles and talk a lot about Herb Brooks, of course, and tell the Soviet perspective too. I went to Moscow and I talked to Viktor Tikhonov and Sergei Makarov, and there's just so much richness in this story, and it really never goes it never goes out of style. I Ken Morrow, the great defender on that team, and went on to not only win the gold medal that year, but then a Stanley Cup with the Islanders, the first of four. He wrote the new afterword, and Ken told me that he has gotten probably 10,000 cards or letters over the years, and they still come.
I love that afterward. He talks about it. Here he is, 60-some years old, and meets a guy at a bar or something, and the guy texted back and forth with a friend, and the friend went nuts because he was talking to a guy from the Olympic team. It's amazing, isn't it, how this is held and the interest in it is held?
It really is remarkable, and I think it just shows it speaks to the purity of this moment. There's you know, we all know there's a whole lot to be cynical about in this world and in the sports world, but I mean these were literally a band of almost exclusively college kids, the youngest U.S. Olympic team ever, and they're going against the mighty Soviets, the greatest team ever assembled, a team that had beaten the NHL All-Stars 6-0 the year before. They had no shot, except nobody told them they had no shot. And it just, people may remember or may not, Larry, but 13 days before they were on the ice in Lake Placid, February 22nd, 1980, they met the U.S. and Soviets played in Madison Square Garden, and the Soviets won 10-3, and they put the brakes on. It could have been worse. And, you know, when I talked to Sergei Makarov, I said, did that make you overconfident? And he laughed, and he said, what can change in 2 weeks? Well, it turned out quite a bit can change.
Oh, man. John in Toma, let's go to you. John, thanks for calling.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I remember that game very well. I was in the military over in Germany at the time, like 10 miles from the Czechoslovakian border, you know, during the 80s and the Cold War and everything. So, you know, it's really neat because all of us guys basically knew that our young guys, they were all like us, you know, basically the same age, college age when I went in, you know, into the military. And it was great. It was like, you know, we knew they were the Soviet army, you know, the team members, yeah. Most of them were. And it was just great when we won like that. And, you know, it was like a victory for us, you know, all across, I think, the whole military. At all, you know, I mean,
John, that's a good point. I mean, and I think not only for the military, but for the whole country in a way, don't you think, Wayne?
I completely agree with what John said. And, you know, when we look at the larger like socio-political context of those Olympics, I think the Cold War was still raging. The Soviet tanks had just rolled into Afghanistan. The Iranian hostage crisis was going on. Inflation was it was galloping, and interest rates were 18%. And anyone who tried to buy a house around that time will remember it was brutal. And there was this, even President Carter talked about a crisis of the American spirit. And so that was really the backdrop of what happened on the ice. And I really think that has everything to do with why this has just resonated with people for so long.
Yeah. John, thanks again. Appreciate it. I was thinking about that game myself and thinking about, I was a young guy, but a big hockey fan. I had a girlfriend who was also a big hockey fan. And for that night, because the game was delayed, I drove 2 hours to see her to watch the game with her. And I kept the radio off the whole time because I didn't want to get a sudden news flash and let me know what was going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, how mind-blowing is it in this Twitter-dominated age we live in? That game was shown on tape delay. And same as you, Larry, I didn't know the score. And it was really possible to not know the outcome of even something epic like that. The game started at 5:06 in Lake Placid, and so in your time, I think it was 7:06 that the puck dropped. I mean, it was, oh man,
it was really something, and I remember a TV reporter actually getting fired because he said, "Turn off your sound now. I'm going to give you this. I'm going to give the score of the game." And then he went and held up a sign that showed the score, and he got fired. Oh my gosh! Wayne Coffey, our guest today. We need to take a quick look at the news and weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Net, and then we'll be back with him to talk more about his book, The Boys of Winter. Fantastic book, and I hope you, if you haven't read it yet, I hope you have a chance to read it now, because it's a great book. We'll be back with Wayne right after this look at the news. I'm Larry Mueller. That's some music from Miracle on Ice movie. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about the 1980 U.S. Olympic hockey team on the show today with our guest, Wayne Coffey. He's an acclaimed sports journalist, former writer for the New York Daily News, authored 7 books, one of them the New York Times bestseller, The Boys of Winter. It's just been re-released to sort of honor the 40th anniversary of that event in our country's history. So how do you remember the Miracle on Ice? Who was your favorite player? How'd you feel about Coach Herb Brooks? I'd love to have you part of the conversation. Call in. Number's 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And Wayne, I tell you, I loved how you put the book together, and even rereading it again with each period, and then as part of each period, you had certain hockey players sort of highlighted.
Yeah, well, that to me, again, the journeys of the people, Larry, is what. It is really what drives this story. And, you know, again, to provide a little context, that the U.S. did not beat the Soviets again in a hockey game for 11 years after that. Yeah. And in that time, the Soviets outscored the Americans 38-9. I mean, so you can't overplay just how mind-boggling it was what they did that night. And so much of it really hinged on the performance of the local youngster, Magic Johnson. The guy was just, he had 2 goals in that game, and he scored probably the goal that changed everything in the game with 1 second to go in the first period when, you know, he was the son of Badger Bob Johnson, and Badger Bob always taught him, you play until the final horn, you go full out until the final horn. And in the waning seconds of that period, one of his teammates took a shot on the legendary Soviet goalie, Vladislav Tretiak, and the Soviet defenders sort of stood up and kind of relaxed and were skating off. Tretiak made the save, but, you know, was sort of careless with the rebound. And here comes Mark Johnson, full steam ahead, and he's in alone on Tretiak, and he dekes around him and puts the puck in the net with 1 second left in the first period to tie the game. And not only was that just an extraordinary piece of athletic artistry and all-out determination, but Viktor Tikhonov, the Soviet coach, was so incensed that he pulled Tretiak from the game.
The best
and
hockey
Tretiak,
goalie.
This was like pinch-hitting for Babe Ruth in the World Series. You do not take Vladislav Tretiak, the greatest goaltender in the world, out of the game, especially, given that his history was that if he ever let up a soft goal, I mean, he just slammed the door and that was it. So out goes Tretiak, in comes Mishkin. And, I mean, that was, the American guys couldn't believe it. I mean, they came out for the second period, and there's Mishkin in the net. And it, you know, it was the greatest gift. And when I went to see Tikhanov, he said, and to his credit, I mean, he totally owned it. He said, I let my emotions get carried away, and it was the greatest mistake of my coaching career.
Yeah. Yeah, I think he thought that the team would respond better, and it just was the opposite for his team.
It was the opposite. The players were incensed, and they thought it was full blown panic, and it was this incredible adrenaline rush for the U.S. guys, and you know, after they came into the locker room. And, you know, one guy after another told me they had never been in a more supercharged locker room. They didn't even want to wait. They wanted to go right back out on the ice and, you know, and start playing again. It really changed the emotional tenor of the whole game. And you know, Mark Johnson really had everything to do with that. You know, Larry, I want to share, since Mark's a local guy, It would be one of the things that I just love about him. Not only is he just a tremendous player, but the humility and just the low key approach he took to everything. He just never thought he was anything more than a hockey player, and to the point that a very close friend of Mark's in Madison was helping Mark and his wife Leslie some years ago were having a garage sale. They had five kids and they were, you know, getting rid of stuff. So they said, okay, we'll have a tag sale. And their friend comes over and he's, you know, helping them arrange stuff. And he sees a pair of hockey gloves that with a price tag of $3 on it. And the friend, a gentleman named Pete Giacomini, who still lives in the area as well.
Actually, a friend of mine,
might
too.
Might even be listening.
Pete's a friend of mine, too.
Way back with Larry. So Pete says, what are these? And Leslie Johnson says, oh, those are Mark's gloves from Lake Placid. And Pete says, what are you doing? And she says, well, who would want them? And he said, you cannot sell these gloves for three. You cannot sell them, and you certainly can't sell them for $3. And she said, well, I don't think anyone really cares, but this is how much indicative of just, you know, who would really want my gloves. And Pete wanted to prove the point, so he said he took Mark – had his hockey pants from Lake Placid, and Pete put them on eBay and got, I think, $1,250. So,
oh man, that is a great, great story. And now he was one of the great players on that team, and now he's one of the great, or maybe the greatest, women's hockey coach going today.
Yep. No, I can't imagine anyone's better. Five national championships and 525 victories or whatever the total is right now. But you know, the interesting thing about Mark too, Larry, is that his father, who Badger Bob, just a beloved figure in the sport, he and Herb Brooks were basically mortal enemies, at least in the hockey orbit. They just, you know, Herb was the renowned coach at University of Minnesota, and Badger Bob was the same at Wisconsin, and you know, they had their hockey border wars, and it was, I mean, they really could not stand each other. They were going for the same players, and it was as, I mean, this is Hatfield-McCoy stuff, and to the point that Mark thought, like, he might need to not even make the team because Herb disliked his father so much. And sometime before the game started, Herb went over to sat down with Mark, and he just said, hey, listen, you know what, what happens between your dad and me has nothing to do with this. I need you. You're a great player. You're gonna be the, you know, an anchor on this team. And they do not pulled off this miracle without Mark Johnson, that's for sure.
Yeah. Carol in Eau Claire has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Carol.
Hello. I want to tell you that I watched that game, and I had two sons who played hockey, and when they won, I was thrilled through the whole game, and I fell in love with the whole world, especially the Badgers. It was just wonderful. And I have one question.
Sure.
After that big win, did the Olympics then allow professionals to play?
Well, not immediately, Carol. It still took some time. And again, that was part of the charm of these Lake Placid Olympics. This was the last small town, small scale games we will ever see. Again, we should not forget, as miraculous as this hockey game was, I've covered 12 Olympics, maybe the single greatest performance in the history of Olympics, winter or summer, was by Eric Heiden. And Eric Heiden skated, won 5 gold medals at everything from 500 meters to 10,000, skating on an outdoor oval in front of the Lake Placid High School. I mean, it's no one will ever do what he did again. Then shortly after, then there was the IOC opened the Olympics to pros, and that's why we ended up having the dream team. And, you know, as I write in the book, this Herb Brooks did not have a dream team. He had a team full of dreamers, and there's a pretty big difference.
Yeah, absolutely. Carol, thanks so much. Steve in Madison, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Steve.
Hi there. How's everyone?
Good. Appreciate your call. What have you got for us? Oh, we suddenly lost him. So maybe he'll come back and call back and be with us again. So we'll try to get him back. Michelle emailed when she was growing up in Dane County in the 60s and 70s playing hockey on frozen marshes and local outdoor rinks. She thought learning to skate, play hockey was essential to enjoying winter. And it was amazing to be a freshman at Madison that year when her cousin, Phil Verchata, was on the Olympic team. And he was. we lost Wayne here for just a minute.
Oh, no, I'm back.
Oh, you're back. Good. Okay. So Wayne Verchata was on the Olympic team as well.
Yes, he was. Phil Verchota.
Verchota. Sorry. I've lost my train of thought here for a minute. You know, earlier I had Mike Cowan on. I don't know if you've seen his website, WisconsinHockeyHistory.com, but a caller called in to talk about some of the old history, and he talked about the Iron Range in Minnesota. He used to play against Minnesota teams. And talked about it, and I said, you know, there were some really good players on that Olympic hockey team that came right out of that Iron Ridge area.
That's exactly right. Buzz Schneider was a tremendous player. His nickname was probably the fastest skater on the team. He was from Babbitt, Minnesota, and he was known as the Babbitt Rabbit. And then right down the road was John Harrington from Virginia, Minnesota. And that was, this was a place where, and at Eveleth in Minnesota, which is also in the Iron Range, is the home of the U.S. Hockey Hall of Fame. And it takes a little bit of a trip to get there, but they've got some great things there, and it's, so many of these guys, Larry, were just, They were small town guys who grew up, skating on ponds and or in their backyards, and this was just the culmination of a whole life of playing the sport. And one of my favorite stories actually in this that I learned along the way was from Steve Janizak, who was the backup goalie. And Steve's story, actually, Larry, is, gives a little insight into just how single-minded and really tough and unyielding a taskmaster Herb Brooks was. Steve Janizak was an All-American goaltender at the University of Minnesota, won two national championships for Brooks there, and he was the only athlete in the whole Lake Placid Olympics who did not compete for 1 second.
Yeah.
He never even got on the ice, not even when they had a 5 or 7 goal lead against Romania. And Janizak, Steve, just a wonderful guy from White Bear Lake, Minnesota. And Steve just said, you know, I had the best seat in the house for the greatest sports moment of the century. So, and he also met his wife in Lake Placid. So he said, how could I be bitter? But Steve told a story, and I spoke to his dad too. His dad was an electrician. He'd work all day. They'd come home. They'd have supper. And then they would go out at night on a lake, and his father had a Rambler, a car called a Rambler, and you got to be pretty old if you know a Rambler.
Nash Rambler.
Unfortunately, I qualify. And they would turn on the lights of the Rambler, and Steve and his father would play. His father would shoot pucks at him, and they would play hockey until, for, you know, as long as they could go, an hour or two, and you know, I have this image of a father and a son out on a lake in probably 10 below zero playing hockey by the lights of a Rambler. And, you know, these are almost in every case, these are family stories. They're family journeys. And it's to me that just makes it so much richer. And
I couldn't agree more. And I'm, that's why I'm kind of glad it was 25 years before you wrote it, because it helped. I think you've got some perspective on what the kids were like, and then how they turned out.
Yeah, and it's you know, and it, to go back to the game itself for a second, Larry. I mean, it, as we know, the U.S. had 4 goals and the Soviets had 3, and bear in mind too, this was not the gold medal game. The U.S. had to come back and beat Finland on Sunday morning to win the gold. And if they didn't beat Finland, there was a chance they could get shut out of medals altogether.
Yeah.
So, but in this game, on the Friday night, this was not an even hockey game. The Soviets outshot the Americans 39-16. I mean, it was mayhem out there for long stretches, and Jim Craig had the absolute night of his life, and that's really.
And Jim was
that made it happen.
Yeah, and he was the captain, right? And
no, Michael Ruzzioni was the captain.
Oh, that's right. I'm sorry, Ruzzioni was the captain. I forgot that, and he almost didn't make the team too.
He within weeks before the start of Lake Placid, they actually, Herb Brooks, who the entire time, they had the longest pre-Olympic tour, 61-game tour, and he was constantly playing mind games with the players to keep them sharp, keep them motivated. You know, so he would bring, right before the Olympics, he goes up to Jim Craig and he says, I'm thinking about going with Janizak. You don't look sharp to me. And, you know, Craig was furious. I mean, he'd been the number one goaltender the whole time, and Brooks just, you know, was trying to, like, light him up, and it worked. And he did the same thing with the Ruzzioni. He even sent, Michael Ruzzioni wore jersey number 21. And Brooks actually sent a number 21 USA jersey to a player named Craig Amala at the University of Vermont, basically saying, this is yours. It's yours if you want it. And Michael Ruzzioni ends up scoring the winning goal, and off the wrong foot, and a wobbly shot, and a broken play. I mean, it was not one of your pretty goals, and but you know, who really cares? I mean, Mike Ruzzioni is still making a living off of that, giving motivational speeches and helping raise money for his alma mater, Boston University, and and good for him. As Herb Brooks likes to say, used to say, the late Herb Brooks would say, Mike Ruzzioni loves free speech. He's just never given one.
Bill in Madison, let's give you a chance to join in. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Well, you know, Mark Johnson had a long history with the Russians. His dad worshipped Russian hockey and used to play films for him all the time. And I remember his freshman year, UW used to play a New Year's Eve game against one of the Russian junior teams, and I can't remember, it was either the Red Army junior team or Gorky Tractor. Mark got behind, he was a freshman in college, you know, 5'7", maybe 150 pounds, got behind the defense twice and rang two off the goalposts, and their coach pulled both defensemen and sat them for the rest of the game.
Wow. Bob, that's actually a great point, because when long before Mark even got to Wisconsin, as he was a high school kid, he would play with his father's teams, and the father, Badger Bob, would always give Mark an old, like a facsimile of a Soviet red sweater, and that's what Mark always played in. And he would pretend that he was, you know, he was Mikhailov or Petrov or Helmut Bolderis or one of these iconic stars. And you know, he talked about how, you know, when he got to Lake Placid, he's of course the first team center, and he's ref's about to drop the puck, and he's looking across at Petrov, and overhears Mikhailov, and he's just thinking, I can't even believe I'm on the ice with these guys. But yeah, he did. He grew up, and Badger Bob loved, you're very right, that's a great point, loved Soviet hockey, and he learned, I mean, Mark was really, he was just awed by how they played and the things they could do on their skates and the, you know, the skill and the motion and the speed, so... And that Mark embraced all of that.
Yeah, he did indeed. Bill, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, are you what kind of response are you getting to this re-release? Hopefully, a good one.
No, it's been great, and it just, you know, again, it people never get tired of talking about it. And as we've seen from some of the callers, Larry, I mean, you remember, I remember exactly where I was, and so many people. So many people do, and you know, when you think about it, in our lives, a lot of times the things where we can tell people even decades later exactly where we were things that were bad news. You know, where
yeah.
For me it was the JFK assassination on November 22nd, 63, and then the Bobby Kennedy assassination, Martin Luther King, and now I'm sure for a whole generation of people this horrific tragedy with Kobe Bryant and his daughter and the seven yeah. other players will always remember where we were. And here's
a positive
an uplifting moment where we remember where we were.
Wayne, hopefully it'll be less than 5 years before we talk again. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on, Larry. It's great to be with you.
Wayne Coffey, author of The Boys of Winter. If you haven't had a chance to read it, please do. Even though you don't know the outcome of the game, I still found it exciting as he wound up the book. And there's a lot of good information in there. A lot of fun visiting with him. And thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store.